This is James Eklund, and you lucky and gorgeous people are listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations. By the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. By Black & Veatch, building a world of difference. By 120 Water, new rules need new tools. By 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience. By Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operation services. By Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow. And by Xylem, let's solve water. This is Session 259.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGibson, and thank you for joining me, and thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. We have a fantastic show for you today. David Jordan, the Western Water Resources Lead at Intera, is here to talk long-range water planning, and David gives a great overview of long-range water planning and its evolution, as well as a success story involving a community that implemented a long-range water plan. For those of you expecting a Bluefield on Tap segment, unfortunately, Reese's schedule and mine just didn't match up this month, so you'll have to wait until next time for your Bluefield on Tap segment. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some fantastic sponsors. Our sponsorship lineup includes the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, and Xylem. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education, and I thank you all. And I'd like for you, the listener, to please do me a favor. If you work for or if you work with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact to that sponsor firm and tell them that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far a simple little note of thanks like that will go. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It would be greatly appreciated and, of course, helps others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, I understand that's somewhat important. Well, now it is time for the main event, our interview with Intera's David Jordan. So let's get that water flowing. Well, David, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Dave. How are you?
I am doing fantastic as I'm talking to you. I really look forward to our conversation today. But before we get to that, could you please give us a little thumbnail on your background and how you came to the water sector?
Sure. Kind of a long story, so please let me know if I'm going too long on this. So I'm going to go back to my bachelor's in geophysics from Virginia Tech with a minor in computer science. And at the time, there were very few jobs in the oil industry for geophysicists, which is where one would traditionally have gone into the workforce at that point. There were only four of us at the time that graduated in geophysics. And I had worked for a geochemistry professor doing some geochemical modeling. He suggested that I could consider graduate school. So I went out to New Mexico Tech and got a master's in geophysics with an emphasis in groundwater. My first job was pretty traditional environmental consulting, sampling and characterizing contaminated groundwater and soil. My next job, and this is all out in Virginia on the East Coast, introduced me to some of the quantitative tools that we still use today, geographic information systems and groundwater modeling. Around that time, decided to move back to New Mexico, got a job with a company started by a former New Mexico Tech professor, and got into environmental litigation support. So still looking at contaminated groundwater and soil, but really doing environmental forensics. So fingerprinting to determine who was responsible for what and how much at contaminated sites. So working for insurance companies and people like that, trying to decide how to allocate contamination. So really interesting work. I was recruited by Intera to build up their water resources practice in New Mexico. And so that was about 25 years ago now. And some of the early work I did was using Landsat imagery to quantify irrigated acreages in New Mexico for a state agency. That work actually ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court in the Texas v. New Mexico case, where Texas sued New Mexico over deliveries to Texas from the Rio Grande under the Rio Grande Compact. So that was a very interesting trajectory there. Around 2010, Intera was selected to do a 100-year water plan for the local water authority here in New Mexico. So that was kind of where I got my initial introduction to water planning. So that was a very interesting project. We'll hopefully touch on that in today's conversation. And also in 2014, California passed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which required groundwater plan development for all basins in California, which has led to quite a bit of groundwater planning work for us as a company. And we've also been doing a lot of planning activity in the Midwest that I've been sort of peripherally involved with. So that's kind of what brings us to today.
Yeah, and I'd love to kind of level set, and you mentioned water planning and long range water planning. So what, when someone says they need a long range water plan, what kind of time horizon are we looking at? How can we kind of level set where we are when we're talking?
Sure. It depends on the organization. The project that we did for the Water Authority here in New Mexico, they actually were looking at a 100-year timeline. So that's pretty ambitious. For example, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act work that's being done in California right now, it's looking at sustainability through 2040. So the time horizons really vary. It depends on the organization, but somewhere in the range of 20 to 40 years on the low end to 100 years on the high end.
Got it. And how would you say in your experience in the industry, how are you seeing long-range water planning evolve?
Sure. I think people are, you know, the good way to put it, and one of the big changes I think we've seen is sort of the concept of that stationarity is dead. So in the old days, we might have, if we wanted to do a prediction into the future of, say, surface water, we might have looked at gauge data and surface water flows from the last 50 years and just projected those into the future and used those for planning purposes. But now with climate change, we know that those numbers are going to change. And so that's, to me, one of the biggest changes that we've seen is the impacts of climate change and the fact that this concept of stationarity, that precipitation and river flow could be expected to be similar in the future as to what it has been in the past, has really been a big driver. So there's a lot of work, obviously, with trying to quantify that and trying to get our arms around that. And I think another concept that really comes out of that is that we look at things much less deterministically now and much more with respect to an uncertainty analysis based. So in other words, we don't look for one answer in the future. We look for a range of answers. And so we think, well, we're going to be, maybe we could bookend what the future might look like. And we're going to try and be somewhere in the middle and have adaptive planning in place such that if something changes, then we can make a course correction. So that's another, I think, really big concept that's become more accepted recently, is that the future, we can determine a range of possible futures, and we have to plan to be somewhere in that range, and we don't know exactly where we're going to be in that range.
Right. Hey, you mentioned climate change is a big factor when you're doing long range water planning. What are some of the other factors that that play into determining what that range is that you're trying to figure out?
Sure. Well, another interesting phenomenon, and a positive phenomenon, is conservation has been very, very successful. So it's really interesting to see the changes in demand as a reflect of conservation in many areas. I mean, Albuquerque is a great example where the population has grown quite a bit, but our overall demand is actually down because of conservation. So we're doing a really good job, I think, with conservation because we're serving water to more people. Population is greater, but overall water usage is down because of these very, very strong and focused conservation programs that a lot of utilities have implemented.
Yeah, and you mentioned population growth and its relationship to conservation. I'm curious how population growth factors into long-range water planning, and the reason I'm asking this is I've read in the Wall Street Journal over the past couple of weeks multiple articles about population growth and lack thereof, and you know, we're kind of the UN, you know, sustainability rate or replacement rate. They think it might have dipped below replacement rate already. And so I'm just kind of curious how you factor all these types of things about population growth in and what the relationship is to conservation and things like that.
Sure. Yeah, I've been reading, I think I was just reading one of those articles this morning. There's actually a lot of concern from an economic standpoint as to the fact that we're potentially not going to be replacing our population. But from a water demand perspective, typically we think a lot in terms of per capita usage. So one thing we're trying to do is drive down per capita water usage by conservation. But of course, we always look at the potential impacts of increasing population. So as you have more people in a population, you need to serve more water. And the expectation in the past, and you kind of alluded to this, has been that population is generally growing. So that's kind of the assumption that we're working with. Population is generally growing. Demand is generally expected to increase. However, we look at that within kind of the same sort of a lens as water supply. So demand is, we can get a handle on kind of a range of demand. We usually look at low growth scenario, medium growth scenario, high growth scenario. So there's a big range there in terms of what that might look like. But population very much drives the demand. So that's a big piece of the predictive work that needs to get done to determine how much water is needed into the future. And there's an interesting component there too with you know, here in the West in particular, where a water utility has to typically acquire water rights to then move that water into their water supply portfolio and serve their customers. And there's always a process where the water utility has to show the need for the new water. And so that's getting a lot more complicated with things like climate change, things like population dynamics. So there's a lot of work that has to be done if you're, say, Denver Water, and you need to go out into the marketplace in Colorado and get water rights and acquire water rights. You have to be able to show the water court that you really need those water rights. So you have to have the right kind of predictions to be able to do that. So you have to justify acquiring this new water supply or water rights, if you will, because the regulatory agencies are typically trying to avoid, I don't know if the right word is hoarding, but speculation. So, you know, we don't want particular agencies or organizations gathering up all the water supply and water rights in a region just because they think they might need it someday. So there's an interesting quantification that is taking place with respect to people having to justify their needs into the future and the uncertainty associated with that.
Got it. What about the role of technology? How does that factor into long-range water planning?
Sure. There's a lot of new technology out there. We could spend a whole podcast probably just just talking about that. In my mind, machine learning and artificial intelligence is very interesting and very exciting on that front, because when it really comes down to it, we are machine learning is good at pattern recognition. So it's good at sorting through big data sets, the kind that we look at in our business, precipitation, stream flow, weather patterns, population dynamics, the economics of population dynamics. They have all this data, and you're trying to find correlations, and so you're trying to use those correlations to predict what the future might look like. And so machine learning, I think, has, and we're really just in the beginnings of this, I think machine learning has really a lot of possibility to help us with some of that pattern recognition. A good example is Google has developed a machine learning-based flood forecasting tool, particularly for areas such as Africa and the developing world where there's not a lot of data. So they've got probably precipitation data, and they're trying to translate that into doing some flood forecasting. And so it's a very interesting program, really good example, I think, of where you have big data sets. You're looking at essentially correlating precipitation to the potential for a flood, using the machine language and artificial intelligence to tease out those patterns. Whereas previously in the past, and of course this is still done, you might build a watershed model, characterize your watershed, and then use that as a predictive tool. Now, people are understandably uncomfortable with these sort of black box machine language models, because in the past we've really wanted to understand the physical processes. And with machine learning, it is a bit of a black box. It's just looking at correlations between, for example, rainfall and runoff to do flood forecasting. So there's a certain level, I think, of discomfort in using these new technologies, but I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the future.
Yeah, it just feels like the technology is constantly improving. And so the more refined those AI models and machine learning models get, the more they'll be accepted. At least that's my layman's perspective on it.
Yeah, I agree. I'll give an example, a recent example. I was on a technical review panel for a water. Actually, it was a handful of water utilities out in California. And we were looking at a groundwater basin with a stream running through it. The stream, it was near the ocean, so the stream ultimately emptied into the ocean. So this groundwater basin sort of had two parts. There was an upper part and a lower part. They were separated by kind of a spillover, where sort of a high point in the watershed. So the water in the groundwater in the upper part of the groundwater basin had to reach a certain height, if you will, before it spilled over into the lower part. And there was a lot of data. There was a lot of instrumentation, surface water data, water levels. And so to me, that really seemed like a great example of where, well, we can do a machine learning based kind of approach, look at what's the relationship between stream flow, groundwater levels, at what point do we get spillover into the lower part of the basin. But it was interesting, because when you bring these kind of ideas to the table, there are people, for example, the geologists wanted to spend a lot of time characterizing and talking about that bedrock high between the two basins. Whereas I personally was a little more willing to, well, let's just see if we can figure out a pattern here, and let's use machine language to do that. So this is an example where traditionally it had been done using deterministic models, and the group was a little bit resistant to a machine learning type model, but I think that's going to change.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. So given all the uncertainties, the advancing technology, things like that, if you're a water utility, you know, what are you looking at when you are making investment decisions, and how are you going to prioritize where you put your limited funds?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think most water utilities, the challenge is there are a lot of moving parts. So we have clients that come to us, for example, and so they have a groundwater source of supply, and it may be subject to, there may be groundwater contamination. Maybe there's a groundwater plume, a contamination plume that they don't want to be drawn into their wells. Or maybe that groundwater aquifer is connected to a stream. And so if they pump too much groundwater, then they're depleting the stream. So maybe there's a groundwater piece that looks something like that. And then oftentimes there'll be a surface water piece with perhaps seasonal availability. Oftentimes with surface water, there are ecological considerations. So you might have low flow limits because of, say, an endangered fish in the stream, or temperature requirements for the habitat. Oftentimes you'll have also an imported water source. So, for example, a lot of the water agencies in California get water from the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. And, of course, there are costs and constraints and uncertainties associated with that imported water source. And then you may be doing, say, water recycling, which is where you take treated wastewater, run it through an advanced treatment process, and then perhaps through an environmental buffer, such as underground storage in an aquifer. So you might have multiple sources of water, imported water, recycled water, groundwater, surface water. They all interrelate. And we're generally being asked to, people will come to us and say, well, we have a groundwater model, we have a surface water model, we have an ecological model, you know, we have a schedule of imported water deliveries. You know, how can we put all that together under one wrapper and figure out the optimal solution? So I think really that's kind of where the industry is headed from the utility perspective, is these decision support tools that hopefully will allow organizations to look at the temporal and spatial attributes of their different sources of supply, and at any given time, try and determine where they should be drawing from in an optimal way, both from an economic standpoint, of course, and a stakeholder standpoint, and an environmental standpoint. So these are very complicated systems, which I'm going to mention machine learning again, which there are very complicated dynamics between all the elements of these different sources of supply. And there are patterns, I think, associated with using the various sources of supply. So I think that's where we're going to see machine language being applied more and more in the future.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Now, how does all this intermesh, like utility planning decisions? You've kind of said, we talked about the water courts earlier, about how you have to prove up that you actually need the water so that there can't be, you know, for lack of a better word, hoarding. But how do the regulatory frameworks kind of, and the policy implications play into all this? How does that layer in?
Sure. I think we should also mention the stakeholder elements, because that's becoming a very, very important part of all this. I think going out to the public, getting their input. Sometimes there are very difficult decisions that need to be made with respect to, say, building a particular project or using a particular supply, and, you know, the pros and cons of each. So we're seeing a lot of utilities go out to the public, have working sessions, have almost board game type sessions where you actually give the stakeholders various supply options and the pros and cons of each, and, you know, have them make kind of the difficult decisions. And of course, a lot of this drives capital spending and where capital should be spent. And there's we really have to be careful about what's called stranded assets. So we know that, for example, storms are going to be less frequent, but perhaps more intense in the future due to climate change. So you'd like to build facilities that can capture all of that runoff, but you don't want to build a large facility that maybe only fills every 10 years, for example. I'm just kind of putting the number out there. So on the capital improvement side, I think there's optimal places where you want to build something that's, for example, big enough to the capture is a significant amount of the runoff, or store the right amount of a river in a reservoir, if you will, without being too big or too small. So there's kind of that sweet spot you're always trying to find.
Do you have any case studies or examples that you can point to in terms of kind of successes for long range water planning?
Sure. I think what we did here in Albuquerque has been very successful. So one of the foundational aspects of good long-range planning is kind of like your 401k. You want to have a diversified investment portfolio. You want to have some bonds, low risk, maybe low risk, low return, but very, very dependable. You want to have some small cap stocks and big cap stocks. So you really need a range of investments, if you will, in your water supply portfolio. So City of Albuquerque for many years was primarily dependent upon groundwater. Groundwater is kind of like a savings account. You know, you can draw on it for a long time, but eventually you do draw it down. So in the late 2000s, Albuquerque built a project to begin to divert surface water, which actually comes from the Colorado River. It's called the San Juan Chama Project. So it's water that's captured from some tributaries of the Colorado, up in the state of Colorado, brought through a tunnel through the Continental Divide into a lake in northern New Mexico, and then down the Chama, and then down the Rio Grande. And so we had seen for years the groundwater levels dropping. But once we started bringing the surface water in, and obviously we're using less groundwater, we actually began to see the levels in the aquifer rise. So, you know, bringing in that additional supply into your portfolio is a really good way to make sure that you're in good shape in the long term. Now, surface water, it's more like a stock than a bond, because there's more variability. So there's certainly, in a dry year, sometimes we can't use our surface water, and so we rely on the groundwater. But in the years when there's excess surface water, we try and use that as much as we can, allow the aquifer to recover. And also, to the extent that we can, take that surface water and store it underground using managed aquifer recharge. So it's kind of that concept of, having a diversified portfolio. I think that's kind of a foundational concept.
Yeah, terrific. So one of the questions that I had on my list here was, given all these challenges, given you know, uncertainty and building the right infrastructure and things like that, is there a role for public-private partnerships in developing water infrastructure? And if so, what do you kind of see as the best role for 3Ps or P3s?
Sure. I think they are. I think there is. I think that's a little controversial even now. But there are. I was leading a panel session recently, and one of the folks on the panel session was from the Mojave Water Agency out in California. And so Mojave Water gets water from the State Water Project, so they have a supply of water. And they're in the process of building managed aquifer recharge projects to store water underground. And so I posed the question, you know, is there kind of a private toll road analog in water, where maybe a private entity would come in, build the aquifer storage facility, if you will, charge Mojave Water some amount of money to store the water and to kind of manage the facility. So I think there's a place for things like that, where, you know, maybe some of these public water agencies don't necessarily have the funds to build these kinds of projects, but there's certainly the opportunity to build them. And that's maybe where some private funding can come into the picture. I think it's still pretty new. I think there's still a certain amount of public opposition to that. People are a little bit concerned about having private entities kind of involved in the water space, but it's definitely growing. I think it's got some legs at this point.
I tend to agree with you. And, you know, the biggest thing about P3s to me is transparency to the public. You know, you can't have a, you talked about black box for AI and machine learning earlier. And I think that, there have been P3 contracts that are a little kind of black boxy in how the private entity is making money off the public. And that's when I think there gets to be problems. So I think transparency is a big issue.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. I think that there's work to be done on the stakeholder involvement front with 3P type projects. So I think there's work to be done to get people comfortable with the process. And because I think there's some sense that, maybe it's kind of the black hats and the white hats and maybe the private funding type entities don't have the public's best interest in mind. But I don't see why that necessarily has to be true. And I really do think if the private funding entities can provide funding for some of the types of projects maybe that a water utility couldn't do on its own, that there's definitely some benefit to doing those kinds of projects.
Absolutely. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on today. You've been terrific. I've learned a tremendous amount about long-range water planning because it's not something that I tend to deal with all the time. And so it was great having you on. So thanks so much. Do you have a leave behind message that you want to make sure the listeners depart this our time together with?
Sure. I would say after listening to the podcast today, just give it some thought when you turn on the tap and water comes out. There's a lot of machinery behind the curtain and a lot of people working very hard and a lot of thinking being done. The interesting thing about water, I think, is that it has to be 100% reliable. There aren't really that many other services, if you will, that are that reliable. And I heard an interesting quote from a gentleman from Castle Rock Water up in Colorado not too long ago, and he said something to the effect of, there's nothing else that you can have thousands of gallons of delivered to your home in the middle of the night for just a couple of dollars.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think we've gotten spoiled, at least in the U.S., about how cheap our water comes. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, we absolutely have. So I would encourage people to be grateful for the sorts of service that we enjoy with respect to clean water in the U.S. and the work that goes on in the background to make all that happen. There's a lot of people out there that are working really hard night and day to make sure that we have what effectively comes to 100% reliability in most of our water systems, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Absolutely. Well, David, again, thanks so much for coming on. For those who want to find out more about you, more about your work at Intera, where can they go to get that information?
They can go to the intera.com website or my email, which is djordan@intera.com, or you can look me up on LinkedIn.
Terrific. Well, again, David, thanks so much. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you again soon. Appreciate your time. Thanks. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Absolutely great interview by David. What a terrific look at long-range water planning. I found particularly interesting how it has evolved over time, as well as how AI and machine learning have impacted long-range water planning. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast and click the first link that comes up. That's the landing page on the Bluefield Research website. For those longtime listeners, you are well aware that Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliated entities. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, the podcast gets a home on the web. Well, you can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for a newsletter at that landing page I mentioned as well. Well, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give you a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, and Xylem. And this show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And thank you for listening, and thank you for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.